About child development in this lecture, but I'm going to go back and reiterate a couple of things, address the slides that we didn't get to in the first part, the intro to human development. So I showed you the Denver 2 developmental screening, and that's a tool that physicians could use when they do a developmental evaluation, or at least that physicians should be able to read, let's say, if they have the results in their office. This is showing you a flow chart, and it's meant to demonstrate a workflow for someone doing early developmental screenings that it's possible, or one way of thinking about developmental screenings is that you can involve the parents by having them fill out forms in the waiting room and having nursing staff screen for whether there's any abnormalities that you can address with the parents. So if they screen negative, and these are the parents' report of different developmental achievements or delays, and if they screen negative, the physician can discuss the results, and if there's no concerns, the baby will essentially be referred for the next well baby appointment. If there are some minor concerns, it gives the physician a chance to look over and discuss those concerns with the parents. And if there's major, the physician may want to do a more comprehensive developmental assessment or refer for a service that can. If the parents indicate some developmental concerns, they're screened positive, then the physician can get right to it with them in the appointment, confirm whether they are indeed developmental delays or possibly just lags, that it's within the kind of normal range but not necessarily indicating a delay just yet. A physician can do that, and again, with the goal of providing some guidance for the parents, what's normal, what's not normal, possibly referrals for special services if needed, or more intensive follow-up or tracking or monitoring in the first 2 years to determine whether there is a developmental delay. So what are some red flags that might cause the physician concern? One would be absent reflexes at birth. That would indicate some brainstem failures, right? And so the physician would be immediately alerted, which would be a red flag at birth. Persistent fisting. Fisting is not to be confused with the palm or grasp. Fisting is something that if a physician is holding their hand in a fisted position for a long period of time, maybe not using it in terms of toy use, because if they're fisting after 3 months, it might keep them from being able to do toy usage or transferring objects from one hand to another, and that might indicate a delay or some sort of developmental concern that becomes more apparent as the child ages. So what do I mean by that? I'm thinking of the cerebral palsies, and that if there's some sort of defect in, let's say, cortical spinal development that is not allowing the child to have fine motor use of their hand, you won't see that at birth. That not until the cortical spinal tracts develop can you actually see or diagnose the cerebral palsy, because that requires some maturation of the cortical spinal tracts. And one sign of that would be persistent fisting after 3 months, but a lot of times it doesn't come to the physician's attention until much later, maybe at the one-year appointment where the mother or the father are saying that their child is still not really using hand, it's staying in a flexed position. Failure to reach for objects at 6 months is considered a developmental concern. It might indicate some motor, visual, or cognitive deficits. An absent smile at 3 months, and so if the baby doesn't seem to be spontaneously smiling, the reflex smile would have disappeared, then, but they're not spontaneously smiled at 3 months, and it might suggest some attachment, possibly even abuse or maternal depression. If they're not babbling at 6 months, they should be checked for a hearing deficit. But beyond that, if their hearing is fine, give it a little more time to see if they're developing some early speech. Persistent mouthing of objects, so that's putting objects in their mouth at 12 months, can indicate a cognitive delay, and so they shouldn't, at that point, they shouldn't be putting everything in their mouth by 12 months. And if they are persisting in this kind of non-communicative speech at 1.5 years, so essentially most speech in early, in the first year, you know, blah, 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 that's not communicative, but they start to develop speech to communicate their basic needs in the second year, where they're saying, you know, I'm hungry, thirsty, food. But if they're not doing that at 1.5 years, then it might indicate a pervasive developmental disorder or some cognitive deficits. And then speech articulation errors, so difficulties in their expressive speech might also be a warning or precursor for speech and language disorders. And then any regression from a previously acquired skill definitely raises alarm. If a child is not going forward in their speech and language or in their social development, but going backwards, then that raises a physician's concern about an autism spectrum disorder. Similarly, restricted and repetitive interests or stereotyped behaviors would also raise concerns. So autism spectrum disorders, there are signs, and some researchers can show evidence for high risk. Let's say siblings of children with autism can show some early signs at 6 months, but it's not reliably diagnosed until later, when you start to see maybe some behavioral restricted and repetitive interest or other social interaction abnormalities as the child then becomes more social and interacts with their peers, or in the case of autism spectrum disorder, doesn't. Okay, so now I'm just going to switch lectures, because that was the end of your lecture 41, and we're going to move into lecture 42, which deals more specifically with cognitive development. But there's a lot of overlap. So we'll start by talking about Piaget. We've already mentioned a lot of his concepts are critical because he was one of the first people to focus on those first 2 years of life and really highlight key concepts in cognitive development in the first 2 years. And his belief was that children are active learners, that they learn by doing. And that philosophy is pretty popular. And a lot of preschools, a lot of Montessori, Waldorf, they believe children they learn by interacting, by doing in the environment, not by just sitting and listening to lectures. So children cannot advance until there are mastery of each stage. So I was talking before about how they have to achieve working memory before, or they have to achieve object permanence, right? They have to know that when an object is not in view, that it still exists, in order to demonstrate more advanced working memory skills. So there are rudimentary signs of the development of a cognitive skill that then develop into a more advanced skill, and it's a hierarchical type of staging. And two key things that Piaget believed, and most cognitive developmental neuroscientists believe, is that in order for skills to develop, you have to have sufficient environmental input, which caregivers, the environment provides, and you have to have brain maturation, that these work together. You can't develop a new skill unless the brain is mature enough for that skill to be developed. The substrates for that skill have been developed. And then you have to have sufficient environmental input, right? So if children, if their eyes are covered, or, you know, from the cat experiments, the visual system is not going to develop normally, that the development of the brain also depends on environmental interactions. So we talked about assimilation, accommodation, and object permanence. And those three things are in the first year what Piaget calls the sensory motor stage. Those are the first 2 years of life. And so there's other things that develop other than assimilation, accommodation, and object permanence. Children also show, in terms of the motor system, their sensory motor system, what is called a reflex action. So it's when the baby does something like they put their thumb in their mouth and they start sucking it. So it's the baby's own body. With a primary circular reaction is when they discover something that they do to their own body, and maybe it gives them a sense of calmness or pleasure, and so they continue to do it. As opposed to a secondary circular reaction, which is when a baby might elicit a response from a caregiver and engage in this type of back and forth. So, you know, cooing, the caregiver does, oh, and the baby goes, ah, you know, and they kind of have this back and forth type of rhythm or synchrony. And that is essentially, you could argue that it's hard to differentiate a secondary circular reaction from a tertiary, but the key here is that in a secondary circular reaction, it's as a baby does something accidentally, gets a response, and then they keep trying to do it. So if a baby kind of is on their little walker, and they have some little toys and buttons and stuff, and they accidentally hit one and a song starts. Then they try to do it again, but they can't really, so they just start waving their hands around and they hit it again and the song starts, and they're really happy. So it's like they understand some cause and effect between their own bodies and the environment or other people, other caregivers. But they're not voluntarily. They can't just go right to the button that makes the song start yet. When they can do that, when they can plan and execute a stimulus response pattern, then they can. That's essentially a tertiary circular reaction. So in that, they can generalize. So they can understand that if they step on a squeaky toy and it makes a squeak, that if they pick it up and squeeze it, it'll make a squeak sound. So they start to be able to interact with the environment in a more voluntary, planned way. So what would that depend on? Again, everything we've talked about. Working memory. They'd have to be able to think a little bit symbolically that if I do this with my foot, then I squeeze it. So again, this hierarchical staging, that the achievement of one skill depends on the achievement of other skills. So Piaget talks about the sensory motor stage from ages 1 to 2, and from ages 2 to 7, we get into what's called the pre-operational stage, the pre-logical. So children are now using representations, and objects can be represented by words or images, right? And they're able to pretend. So Sarah just mentioned, you know, before she came up and gave the example of, oh, yes, if you take a clay and you put it like this, and the kid can know, oh, that's a snake. So they can imagine that the clay is a snake. They can pretend that it's a snake, right? They have a schema for snakes. They can make a toy look like a snake and pretend that it is a snake. They're still in their egocentric thought in the pre-operational stage. It's still all about them. And Piaget argues that they lack compensation abilities. So what this means is that the children in the pre-operational stage, they fail to understand that if you take one substance, for example, if you take two balls of clay and you squish one of them, that there's compensation, that the squished ball of clay has compensated. Instead of being round and fat, it's now kind of shallow and wider, right? So it's been squished, but it's compensating for a loss in height with a gain in width. But it's the same identity, it's the same amount of clay. So Piaget called this conservation. It's the ability to understand that if you take two things that are the same and you change one dimension of those two objects, that it's still the same amount. So he used glasses of water for this. If you put two glasses of water in front of a child 2 to 7 years of age and you say, okay, I want you, are these the same or are these different? And the child says they're the same. And then you pour one of them into a taller glass that's taller and thinner, like this. And you say to the child, is it the same or is it different? And they'll say, well, it's different. And you'll say, oh, why? This one's more. Why is this one more? Well, it's taller. So a 2 to 7-year-old will make that argument. And the same thing with, let's say, rows of buttons. You say, are these the same or are they different? And he'll say that both row 1 and row 2 are the same. And then if the experimenter, let me do what he told me to do there, actually. Pointer options, laser pointer. Okay. Yes. So if the experimenter spreads out the buttons, right, and it says to the child, are these the same or are they different? The child in the pre-operational phase will say these are different. This one is bigger. And the experimenter says, why is this one bigger? Well, you stretched it out, so it's bigger. They don't understand that this is the same amount. You've just compensated for, you know, one direction with another, a change in one dimension by a change in another. So they achieve that at the next stage, which is the concrete operational stage from 7 to 12. They start to be able to engage in logical thinking. So if you ask a child from age 7 to 12 in the concrete operational stage, or you give them the following scenario. You say, a hammer can break a glass. The rule is, if you hit a glass with a hammer, it will break. And then you ask them, you know, I'm going to hit this glass with a hammer. And you say, what will happen to the glass? The child will say, it will break. No problem. But if you have something that's counterfactual, like if you hit a glass with a feather, it will break. They're already going to go, they don't like that. And you say, I'm going to hit this glass with a feather. What will happen? And they'll say, it's not going to break. It's just a feather. It can't break the glass, right? So they can't understand counterfactual logic, abstract logic, a logical rule that is not immediately obvious in the environment. This is in the next stage that we'll talk about, in the formal operation stage. If you say to a child, you know, the rule is if you hit a glass with a feather, it will break. And then you say to a 14-year-old, you know, I hit this glass with a feather. What happens to the glass? They'll say, it will break. Why? That's the rule. So children in the formal operations can understand abstract rules, whereas in concrete operational, they can understand rules, but only when they kind of map nicely onto reality. So they have an understanding of how to mentally manipulate objects and processes. They've achieved conservation, right? This idea of compensation. So they'll pass those conservation tasks, but they still aren't capable of abstract logic that doesn't nicely map onto reality. But by age 12 and above, they can think abstractly. They can hypothesize about scenarios they haven't seen before and actually test to find out whether their hypothesis is correct or not. And they can engage in higher order thinking, synthesis, analysis, and evaluation. So you can think about Piaget's staging in this overall table from 0 to 12 plus. So we stay in the formal operational stage for most of our lives, as a movement from being somewhat concrete and kind of bound to our sensory input and reactive to more, you know, and single-minded, really, being able to take into account one dimension, to being able to think symbolically, abstractly, to be goal-oriented, not just reactive, to actually plan things and carry them out in sequences, and to be able to multitask. So this movement from a more concrete sensory-bound type of thinking to more abstract, symbolic, goal-oriented thinking, again, depends on some developmental changes in our brains, which we'll get to. Okay, let's take a moment and think about this for all you Pokemon fans. I see one Pokemon fan over there. Did that bother you when you were a kid?
Yeah.
Yeah. It really bothered my daughter when she figured out that it... Okay, give you all a chance to respond. Anyone not get a chance to respond yet? Let me know. Okay. So, this logical rule This is an abstract rule, and it bothers a child who, in their view of reality, that in Pokemon is their view of reality. I mean, they love Pokemon and they follow these rules, and it's not supposed to be. So this rule, actually, this violation bothers them, just like it bothered the kid that you can't break a glass with a feather. You know, this rule is not how they see the world, and so older kids can accept the fact that, yes, there's some violations that, you know, that a fish can evolve into a dragon in Pokemon world. But this, it doesn't bother a young kid. It doesn't bother a four-year-old. Why? Because they just accept whatever. They accept the fact that there are dragons, and they believe that, you know, and that they think Pokemon are real. But the older kid, well, these types of violations will start to bother them because they have some understanding of logic and they want things to follow rules that they observe in the world. Okay. So in early childhood, there's somewhat of a slowing down in physical growth, but it's still, children, of course, are still growing. There's a decrease in appetite. They're able to control their own sphincter and achieve potty training, typically by the age of 5, although there is a great deal of variability in that. They are achieving finer motor control. They can hop on 1 foot by age 4, and they can actually, most kids can dress themselves by age 5. If they're not dressing themselves by age 7, it can raise some concerns, not just about motor development, but also about parental involvement and whether parents are actually letting them develop independently and autonomously. Now, we know that handedness preference emerges at 18 months, but an actual handedness pattern, a lifelong pattern of right or left hand use, is established by age 7. For a physician, it's going to be important that you can do simple things like map a child's height and weight onto a growth chart. And so just to demonstrate, it's fairly simple. If you want to plot a 16-year-old girl who is 90 pounds and 65 inches tall, you would look over here. So her age is 16. So we look up the 16 column, and we map her weight over here at 90 pounds, and her inches are here in stature at 65 inches. So looking at this growth chart, what does it tell the physician? That she's underweight. She's normal in terms of right smack dab in the middle of the curve for her height, but for her weight, she's less than 5% than the normal distribution of weight for her age. So that raises concerns about, for the 16-year-old, eating disorders, for her height, she is underweight. So just simple use of a growth chart. Now, in terms of early childhood brain development, by age 5, the brain is 75% of its adult weight, and by age 6, it's 90% of its adult weight. So there's still some growing that will occur, but largely by age 6, it's achieved a large percentage of its adult weight. There's two major changes throughout early and middle childhood. So the biggest is this continued myelination. Now, there's no more dramatic myelination than we saw in the first year. I mean, that was visible and obvious on those T1 and T2 weighted MRI scans that I showed you. And someone pointed out, and I should reiterate that those major changes, to go back to your imaging class, are because there's no myelin, there's no fatty tissue. And if the T1 weighted MRI scan is sensitive, or MRI is sensitive to fat or water molecules, essentially you're just imaging water when there's no myelin, because myelin is fatty. And so that's why you get no signal. You're imaging water and it looks like CSF on the one-year-old, so from newborn 2 weeks to 1 year. So that white matter development is pretty substantial in the first year. But now in childhood, we're continuing to see a pattern of myelination, particularly of long-range association pathways. So frontal lobe connected to, let's say, most posterior region, the longest tracts are going to be from the prefrontal, the frontopolar region, to the occipital, the visual regions. So those long-range white matter tracts are continuing to develop throughout childhood, throughout adolescence, and even into 20s and 30s. So there's a protracted development of white matter, which is why I would say to my daughter when she was giving me a hard time in middle school, you don't know everything, you're not fully myelinated. And that would usually work to quiet her down. So this continued myelination, and there's somewhat of a U-shaped trajectory in synaptic density. So we're forming new synapses, and we'll talk about this in memory. With activity, there's experience-dependent learning. So we're forming new synapses, and we have an increase in gray matter density, both through the formation of some new neurons, but mostly through synaptic density. And what that looks like in terms of volume on, let's say, quantitative MRI imaging is an increase in frontal gray matter, parietal gray matter, and temporal gray matter with a peak, and then a decrease. So the childhood trajectory of brain development for gray matter, for cortical gray matter, is U-shaped, meaning cortical gray matter goes up and then it starts to decrease. Now that might bother some of you. You might, wait a second, we're getting smarter. Cognitively, we're getting smarter our whole lives. We're learning. Why isn't our gray matter just continuing to go up? That's because there is a point in time in which synaptic density is not the end-all be-all. You need some synaptic pruning. And you need to get rid of some gray matter. And actually, additional learning depends upon synaptic pruning. And this drives researchers crazy because it would be so much easier to map brain and behavior if you had nice linear relationships. But unfortunately, there's these U-shaped trajectories where cortical gray matter will increase, and then the rest of the lifespan will be a slow and steady decrease in cortical gray matter. In adulthood, that's usually due to synaptic pruning, but then in aging, we get this other phenomenon, which is actually atrophy, and we'll talk about that in aging. But in general, this U-shaped trajectory is really robust at this point, and you know, several different studies show that there's an increase in volume and cortical thickness, and then a subsequent decrease. Now, white matter, oh, I should point out, actually, there's also a later peak for temporal lobe gray matter, just to point that out because, you know, in terms of continued language development, why the temporal lobe might be a little different. Perhaps there's some role for continued language, expansion of language and vocabulary, and then it peaks a little bit later than the frontal lobe gray matter and parietal gray matter. But for white matter, there is a linear increase throughout the lifespan. Well, not throughout the lifespan. It actually... Let me be clearer. There's a linear increase throughout childhood and into the 30s, somewhat into the 40s, there's an asymptote, and then through the 50s and 60s, it asymptotes, and then later on in life, there's decline in white matter. But in childhood, what we are noticing is just a linear increase in white matter. And this graph is an old one. It's from 1904 by Fleschig, but it shows what we still find is that the earliest regions to myelinate are the sensory regions. So everywhere in black, primary visual, primary motor, primary auditory, are the earliest regions to myelinate. In gray, these are the tertiary or secondary visual cortices. In this case, tertiary or secondary auditory cortices. They myelinate next, and then in white, we see association cortex. So this is the heteromotor cortex. This is the area that if you look at brain imaging correlates of IQ, that you see these frontal, parietal, and middle temporal regions as later to myelinate. So early childhood, you start to see a development of numerosity. They can count things. They can map, you know, the ideas like 1, 2, and 3, and the symbolic concept of numbers to actual objects. They can count up to 10 by age 5. They have a stronger working memory. They can actually repeat digits back to you about 4 digits by the age of 4. And they are able to develop visual, spatial, visual constructional skills. So these. A three-year-old can trace or draw. If you show them a circle and you say, draw this, a three-year-old can draw a circle. By the time they get to age 7, well, I still have trouble with the diamond, but most 7-year-olds can draw a pretty decent diamond. Episodic memory. So we talked about the rudiments of memory. We saw in the first year of life how much substantial growth there is in the hippocampus, and we also know that the hippocampal, perihippocampal, mammalothalamic tracts, they are all developing. So the point is we don't have the capacity, the neuronal substrates for episodic memory until later in life, until at least age 2. We have some working memory in terms of object permanence or A not B task, that you can know that if someone hides something there, you can reach for it in the blanket where they hid it. But that's different than episodic memory, which is to be able to remember what happened to you, let's say, on your first day of preschool. Most of you can probably remember some things from preschool. That's when your memories start to form, when your hippocampal system is mature enough to actually form long-term declarative memories. You see a continued expansion of language skills. By age 3, children can use as many as 900 words. And they can name colors, tell stories. They use prepositions. At this point, they're making full sentences with ands and buts and ors. They can ask you the meaning of word. They can now expand their own vocabulary. What does zebra mean? What does sky mean? It might drive parents nuts, but that's really important because now they're taking some their own initiative and autonomously seeking out new knowledge. By age five, 90% of their expressive language is intelligible. You can understand what they're saying. I think, you know, you can understand what a lot of 3 and 4 year olds are saying too, but by age five, it starts to become reliably intelligible. And if it's not, then you start to worry about articulatory disorders or expressive language disorders. So it's good for the physician to know some risk factors for slower language acquisition. So males develop language slower. I had a friend, a colleague, who was very worried. I mean, of course, he was high performing. He was a physician and wanted his kid to be, you know, going to Harvard and all that. So he was really worried because his kid wasn't talking by age two. And so he brought, you know, should I get an assessment and all that? But there is some range. So you hate to get too concerned, but there's a little bit of a slower or delayed later development of language in many young boys. So sometimes a physician might worry less, let's say, if a boy's only still using one or maybe two words, but not reliably using two-word phrases by the age of two. Prematurity is a risk factor. Twin births or more than two babies, multiple gestation is a risk factor. Bilingualism, but I want to mention that babies might develop language slower in bilingual households, but later on there's been evidence of cognitive benefits. So in the long run, there might be some cognitive benefits to growing up in a multilingual home. And low socioeconomic status is associated with slower language acquisition. So if there are language delays, it might indicate the need to rule out real disorders like intellectual disability, which is the most common cause of language delays, versus a very specific, domain-specific language disorder, or maybe an autism spectrum disorder. And most of these will require a full assessment. It's at this point you might have to involve a specialist in early development and get a full neuropsychological assessment, because in order to diagnose these, you have to have scores across multiple domains. You have to know how their language functions compare to their social-emotional functions. And if, let's say, socio-emotionally they're fine, but they just have a language impairment, so it's not autism spectrum, and they have no restrictive repetitive behaviors, but they just have language deficits, then you're thinking more language disorder. And we'll get to this more when we talk about neurodevelopmental disorders at the end of the term. So at the age of two, they're really struggling for independence, for autonomy. So what we know is the terrible twos. They're going to be at higher risk for injuries because they're exploring the world, and parents have to let that happen. They'd start to develop more complex emotions like jealousy, pride. So we've gone from the moral reflex, right? It's just a rudimentary form of emotion, a startle response to embarrassment, to turning red in the cheeks if they feel some sort of social embarrassment. So that's quite a development. And an interesting development when they can think of things, or they can have their own fears. Things that, I mean, this is going to haunt us the rest of our life, this development, where we can actually come up with things to be afraid of. So nightmares and fears are more basically a fear response that is elicited not by being dropped backwards in the moral response, but having a thought of something scary, right? Going to bed and thinking about something like some monster that you saw in a cartoon, and then they have nightmares, and they can make themselves scared based on representations in working memory. So this, again, can be a real problem later in life when people come up with things to be afraid of all the time, even though they're not immediately in front of them. Might serve as, you know, as a basis for later development of anxiety disorders. But fortunately, we also develop emotion regulation, which allows us to control those fears. So we might think of something that makes us afraid, but we can also use our prefrontal lobes to think of something else that makes us calm or reminds us that that fear is not real, that it doesn't actually exist in the environment. So gender identity develops by age three. And this is controversial for some people. Some parents don't want to believe that when their child, who's age 3 or 4 or 5, tells them that they are a gender that doesn't match their biological sex, that a physician might have to counsel a parent that a child does have some sense of gender identity at a very early age. They start to understand turn-taking, sharing, and social rules by age 3, and engage again in cooperative imaginative play at age 3. This is getting into some of the Piaget things we talked about in the pre-operational stage. Imaginary friends. So they have a rich imagination. 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds, they might just make stuff up. So I'm sure you've seen this in your nieces or nephews, your own children. They just tell you things and they're not true. They have a hard time differentiating, you know, fact from imagination. And they're not lying. So it's not that you don't discipline them by saying, stop telling lies. Why are you lying? For them, they're just not able, or their brains aren't able to differentiate fact from fiction, as well as older children. They start to develop a sense of their attractions, their sexual orientation, by age 5. So that comes early. Of course, you know, the hormones and everything to act on that don't come later, but they have a sense of what they're attracted to as early as age 5. And they tend to be more interested in social conformity at the age of 5 as well. So now moving into middle childhood, which would be called which Piaget stage? Concrete operational. Right, ages 7 to 12. So we still see a steady increase in their height and weight. Boys start to weigh a little bit more than girls at this point. Hormonal changes. Sometimes as early as age 7, you can start to see some hormonal breast development in females, some body hair as early as age 7. Permanent teeth, you usually arrive by age 11. This is why, I don't know if you've seen this phenomenon where you get Chris holiday pictures, you know, and they always, you have the cute little kids and the adults and nice little scenes, but as the kids age and they get into their adolescence, you don't get those pictures as much of the kids. It's because they look really funny, right? So parents stop sending pictures of their kids for holiday cards because, and I noticed this with my friends, it's like, I used to get those cute baby pictures, but they stop sending them when they're teenagers because, you know, teenagers look kind of funny. They have big adult teeth, you know, and so there's some asymmetries in their development. They have these adult teeth, and they start, you know, sometimes they're developing, and so it's a little awkwardness there, but that kind of evens out at the end of adolescence and in the 20s, so. Children get, of course, there's still this continued development of their fine and gross motor, and here's where you start to see a great deal of variability. That some kids are going to be athletes and some kids are just not so interested, right? So there's a lot of variability in motor development, and a physician isn't really concerned unless there's clear, obvious delays in motor coordination. By middle childhood, we know that the law of conservation is achieved. By the concrete operational stage, you also have the ability to look at differences. This is why in all the elementary school, you might remember some of the worksheets. Is this the same? Or is this bigger? Is this more? Is this less? All these worksheets where they're thinking about differences in size and characteristics in elementary school. They can infer relationships between things. So they know if Sally is taller than Jane and Jane is taller than Michael, that Sally is taller than Michael. So they can think logically, and they can do transitivity, it's called, to be able to infer relationship among disparate elements. Also, they can learn to memorize things, categorize things to improve their episodic memory. They understand death by age 8. And in language, we go from somewhat egocentric speech to social speech. And there's a vast expansion of the vocabulary from that we basically have about 50,000 words by age 12. So vocabulary will continue to expand, you know, even through the lifespan. I continue to use new words all the time, but nowhere near the expansion that's seen in childhood. And then children start to display or understand social rules in terms of boys, you know, may be less emotionally reactive and girls more. These types of social cultural rules begin to get internalized. Also, we see that language development is facilitating some regulation of emotion, that you can, you know, this idea when parents say, use your words, to get a child. Don't be upset. Tell me why. Tell me what's happening so that they can use words and language to actually regulate, control their emotional response. And there's also, again, with more development of the prefrontal lobes, a better ability or more robust ability to downregulate an emotional response that comes more from, let's say, the amygdala and hypothalamic initiation of a fear response, a stress response, that kids become better able to calm themselves as their prefrontal lobes develop. Organized sports start to become possible, cooperative play, they learn the rules of the game. So all these things come together, right, from their cognitive thinking, their motor skill development, so they can actually play sports and they care about social rules so they can be a team player. So all of that comes together nicely, and we start to see some emphasis in schools on cooperative sports play. And they also develop competitiveness, they compare themselves to others, they understand fairness, which is really important in sports, and generosity. And they can take another perspective. They can understand what it's like to be the loser, and they can feel sad for the loser, and they can go and shake their hands and feel, some kids, they really take that to heart. They like winning, but at the same time, they feel so bad for the losers, and it's really a conflict, and you see this in young kids. Okay, just a quick check on whether you're thinking about emotion regulation and what regulates it or what supports it. Okay, anybody not responded? Okay, this was the tough differential. So yes, you need the amygdala for emotional expression, and development of the emotion system requires sufficient, development of the amygdala. But what do you need for emotion regulation? It illustrates the point that I've mentioned a few times. You need the prefrontal lobe to downregulate, to control, to modulate, whether it's brainstem reflexes or later in life more, complex emotions, that the prefrontal lobe, still it's the same principle. The cortex helps us regulate and fine-tune our brainstem or our subcortical mediated responses. So in this case, the reason why it's prefrontal lobe is because if I were to say maturation of which brain region supports emotional expression, I would have said the answer then would have been the amygdala. But because it's emotion regulation, that's why it's a prefrontal cortex. It's regulating the responsiveness of the amygdala. Okay, so some of the biggest risks in toddlerhood are injuries, poisoning, drowning. Why? Because they're going to explore, they're going to swallow stuff that they find, and it could be poisonous. So that's why you have, this type of childproofing of households when kids are able to walk and explore. And unfortunately, high incidences of abuse and maltreatment can lead to injuries that come to physicians' attention. So ages 3 to 6, it's usually injury due to trauma. They fall downstairs. They have trouble because they're exploring the world. Age 7 to 12, more chronic medical conditions, injuries being provoked by their friends to do these kinds of I dare you things, or learning attention disorders are a big focus of physician attention from 7 to 12. I'm just going to mention one word about the importance of poverty and considering the depleted or depleted resources in your patient's environment and how that can impact nutrition. Their risk of chronic conditions, exposure to lead or environmental toxins, has, because they might live in a housing project where there's still lead paint. There might be increased family stress, exposure to drugs or violence, or lack of healthy options for food and proteins and animal proteins in the home. So getting sufficient animal proteins can support brain development and growth, physical growth as well. So you might start to see kids who are have changes or some delays in their physical stature, their growth, from not having sufficient proteins in their diet, and lack of access to health care. So one study showed that this type of the influence of poverty is pretty strong on brain development and academic achievement, and up to 20% of the variance in achievement could be attributed to differences in the frontal and temporal lobes of children from impoverished environments. So it illustrates this point that you need brain development, you need changes in structure to support changes in development and achievements and function. So the leading causes of death below age of one are congenital abnormalities of the type you talked about with Dr. Mandalineni, so these prenatal malformations, and low birth weight, birth complications, sudden infant death syndrome, and injuries. But at age 1 to 4, injuries goes up to the number one leading cause of death. So it is a big issue, preventing childhood injuries, and that's why there's been so much effort, at least in the U.S. and other countries, to child-proof homes to try to prevent these types of injuries. It's worth pointing out that the U.S. actually ranks quite low in terms of infant mortality, that it's number 26 of 34 developed nations, and worldwide, 56 of 224. So some of you might put this together and realize that one of the problems is there's poverty in the U.S. too, and a lot of the poor kids are at higher risk for these factors that can contribute to infant mortality. And finally, worldwide, we see that neonatally, the causes of injury and death are more linked to perinatal complications, but in the first year, postnatally, in the world, it's more about communicable diseases. And so these are preventable. So there's lots of room for improvement in terms of eliminating or decreasing preventable communicable diseases globally. Okay, thank you for your attention.